Welcome to a special summer edition of the Parcast, bringing you experts and insiders from Wall Street, Washington, and the world. And now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thanks so much for joining us again this week. Brand new Farcast, September 2nd. We made it through the summer. Ladies and gentlemen, we made it through the summer. We have a terrific Farcast for you this morning. Jim Labenthal from Cerity Partners. We're going to go through what's happening on Wall Street. Then with Dan Mahaffey, there's a Supreme Court ruling that actually didn't strike down. I won't say it upheld, but it didn't strike down a new abortion law in Texas and what that's going to mean procedurally and how that's going to change the debate in Washington, at least with perhaps the president's approval ratings. And then finally, my segment three guest, Josh Lipinski, is a war expert, strategy expert, military expert from Capitol Hill, from Washington, who's going to be discussing with us Afghanistan, what this withdrawal means, whether he thinks it was a good idea or not, and what he would have done differently, and what this means now for U.S. readiness around the world, particularly if we look at places like Taiwan, if we look at Ukraine. Are other people still worried about us, or do they think if we can't figure out how to do an evacuation, we certainly can't do much else? Actually, I know what he says about that. He said that would be a big mistake to underestimate the U.S. But first, so you're going to want to listen, folks. This is a good one, I promise. Jim Labenthal is always a good one. In fact, he's one of the best ones. Partner at Cerity Partners, a regular contributor at CNBC on the Halftime Report, and one of the brightest, most thoughtful, nicest guys we ever get to talk to. Welcome back, Jim.
Michael, so good to be on with you. Thank you for inviting me.
We are really, oh, it's always a treat, Jim, when you are on. Jim, markets are making new all-time highs as we come into September. Does that make any sense to you in the world?
Well, I'm chuckling, and I've been looking forward to our morning together because I'm sure you remember it was only 2 weeks ago that
yes.
I passed on with you. And do you remember the hand-wringing we were doing 2 weeks ago?
I'm still hand-wringing. I never stop hand-wringing.
I am too, but I mean, this is a useful exercise to put some perspective here.
Yes.
The market was down 3% in the course of about 2 days.
Oh yeah, and markets were going nuts. The world was coming to an end, according to
exactly. Yeah. And you know, look, I think it's legitimate at all times to be nervous. We are shepherding our clients' assets that are hard earned, hard won, and we want to grow those assets. But we have to have an eye towards any storms that might come over the horizon. So the way we carry ourselves on this topic is appropriate. But I do note that moment of biting our fingernails ended in the blink of an eye. And that has been the story. If you look at the S&P 500, pull up a one-year chart, you had a couple of whooshes down last year before the election, and then it has been straight up and to the right. And I think where we're going from here, just to get to the punchline, is we're still going to be going up and to the right over the next 1 to 2 years. I do think the volatility is likely to pick up. The one thing I hate, I think you hate it too, is the concept that we might be due for a correction. That is a meaningless, useless statement. And if anybody acts on it, they're liable to really significantly hurt their wealth. But, you know, could you have whooshes down of 3, 4, 5% like we did 2 weeks ago? Of course you can. And most likely you will. Maybe it's because of supply chain shortages continuing. Maybe it's because the Fed gets more aggressive. Maybe it's because Congress raises taxes more than the market likes. But underneath this is excellent profit growth, jobs being created, the economy expanding globally. And that's what we should expect, is more profit growth and the markets moving higher.
Jim, I want to clarify a couple of points. For all of the hand-wringing a couple of weeks ago, ladies and gentlemen, Labenthal and I were not really hand-wringing any more than we always do. I mean, we're always worried and concerned. But when we see these dips and we hear this wailing and gnashing of teeth, we always look back and go, "You cut it out. Are you serious? Markets go down. Duh."
And, let me jump in there because I think it's important to note that neither one of us was saying let's change our stance.
Oh,
neither
no.
one of us was talking about selling a single stock.
And no, you don't react to short-term markets with your long-term investing ever. ever. You have a discipline and you do what you should do, and that's how you make money. In fact, I've written a piece this week. I believe it will go out later this morning. That basically I looked back and took a look at where markets would be if following basically all of their current trends in place, if we hadn't gone through COVID and hadn't gone through the stimulus. So I took the earnings growth that we were seeing in January and February of 2020 through 2019, the debt, the stimulus, the everything else, the trend for the market. And I show basically that if the pandemic hadn't come along, we would actually be lower according to trends on earnings, stock prices, bond yields, everything else. We would be lower than we are now. So that basically, and it's a little bit of a stretch, but basically because of the pandemic, we are higher. And I question whether that really makes sense. And my answer was, I think it does, because of all of the stimulus that strengthened the balance sheets of the consumer, and the consumer 70% of the U.S. economy. And therefore, yes, it makes sense, but don't ever ignore the debt. We still keep looking like we're going to ignore this debt, Jim. And are you in that camp?
As always, Michael, I love these conversations. You go and you scratch where I have an itch. You know what I think? You know what I think all this fiscal
stimulus? Jim.
Yeah, maybe that was a little risque, but I didn't mean it that way.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. No, but no.
It's an intellectual.
You're a handsome man too, Jim. I got to say.
It's an intellectual itch.
Absolutely. Okay, let's go with that.
You know what this fiscal stimulus that blew up the debt did? It refinanced everybody's credit card debt.
Bet your ass.
It refinanced a ton of corporate debt. You basically took the debt that was on consumers' balance sheets at 12, 15, 25%, and you put it on the country's balance sheet at 1.3%.
Yep.
Wow. Okay, by the way, that's not good for the financial sector. However, it clears the slate. It clears the slate for that credit card debt and those mortgage debt and the auto debt to start rising again.
Until they run them up again, because they're going to run them up again. Which is, I think, part of your thesis as to why the, you know, path of least resistance for share prices, as you opened today's segment, was still higher over the next couple of years.
And if you hear the exhalation, the sigh, it's because we all know. We all know at some point the federal debt level is going to bite us in the tush. It's not in the next 12 months. It's likely not in the next 2 years. It's sometime. I worry about my children's future. I don't mean to be whistling past the graveyard. I just don't think that now is the right time to be investing over concerns of the federal debt level. Someday, just not right now.
Okay, so how do you deal with this, Jim? You know, Chuck Prince years ago famously said, you have to dance when the music's playing. Jim and I are saying, you've got these fully valued markets. We're worried about this debt. We have this, but it's still going up. And while it's going up, you need to own it. You need to participate. We said at the beginning, you don't change your investment discipline just because you start to get worried about stuff. In fact, you never change your investment discipline. Your discipline is the one consistent thing through all the highs and lows. It's going to save you, that investment discipline. So be really clear about it. But Jim, how do you have that discipline while these worries are lingering and haunting you and kind of keeping you awake, at least at cocktail hour?
Great setup, Michael. So let's take two parts of what you just said. How do you have that discipline? You recognize that it is from risk that opportunities to earn returns on your money comes. And it's just that simple. You cannot sit there and think that it's easy. It's not supposed to be easy to make money. It's supposed to be hard. But I love what you said before that, because there's something in this market for everyone's discipline, no matter what it is. If you have more of a value orientation, as I do, you can look at the reopening trades and you can look at all the sectors of value, whether it's financials, industrials, energy, and see great opportunities there. If you are on the other end of the spectrum, a hyper growth manager, I saw Kathy Wood today made a comment about auto sales, and she said, look at how auto sales are down, and everybody is saying that it's because of the chip shortage. She said, I don't think so. I think it's because electric vehicles are poised to take over and that consumers don't want gasoline-fired engines. I disagree with her. However, my point is that this is a market in which if you have a thesis, you can find ways to invest. If you want to be in the middle of the road between Cathie Wood and me, you can look at the FANG stocks, which have one heck of a bid to them right now. I mean, look at Apple. That thing doesn't look like it wants to slow down, regardless of the fact that it's the biggest stock in the universe. I think what I'm trying to say here, back to your point, how do you deal with this right now? First off, you remember that from risk comes reward. And number two, you stick to your knitting. Whatever your style is, there's something in the market for you right now.
Beware, too. I think a great risk is confirmation bias. You know, just because you do something that works out, you can't really just automatically claim that as part of your discipline, right? Your discipline is here. I mean, Jim has said he has more of a value bias. And I'm going to, that means something to me, which means, and I'll tell you what it means, ladies and gentlemen, it means that he looks at balance sheets. He looks at the debt levels of a company before he will add it to his portfolio. He looks at the earnings and the business model, and he wants to know if there are barriers to entry and competition. How long can that company continue to sell those hamburgers out in the marketplace? What's their market share? What are they paying? What are their profits? What's their debt level? And he wants to know that balance sheet is there and the cash flow is there to see that company through difficult times, because any damn company does well in good times. The expression is don't confuse brains with a bull market, right? Doesn't make you smart because you made money during a bull market. It makes you smart when you didn't lose your ass in a bear market. That makes you smart. And that's just Farr's opinion. Jim, you go ahead and tell me what I got wrong there.
No, I like it. I mean, immediately I'm thinking of the Warren Buffett quote is you never see who is not wearing a bathing suit until the tide goes out. It's another right. way of saying it. Listen, I completely agree. Michael, you always give such good intros to me when I join the show. And I have to say that my discussions with you help propel me into the coming weeks as far as what to do. You know, I think we're both coming to the same conclusion. It's not easy being an investor. Times like now make it seem like it's easy when the worst drawdown you have is 3%. I think everybody has to be aware that you're likely to make money over the next 12 to 24 months, but it's not likely to be as easy as it was the past 10 months.
Let's drill down to a specific. Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you.
Say what you were going to say, Michael.
So let's go to a specific, because this is a problem that I'm actually wrestling with. I have a number of positions that I've held for a long time that look to be very fully valued. Some I would tell you are moving towards the expensive end of the range. And my capital, my cost basis is so low. So this is a great curse of success. We bought stuff, it's gone way up, and I don't want to take a 25% hit in paying capital gains taxes in order to not have a place to redeploy that cash. Other stocks are also expensive, and I've got to take a 25% hit on some things that I think are wonderful. So let's look at Apple, for instance. Everybody I know has a big capital gain in Apple. You said Apple's the biggest company out there and people keep flooding into it. How do you look at Apple and the size of your position? How do you make a decision about it and wrestle with those gains?
So that's a great question. And Apple, I think it's around 6.5% of the S&P 500. So it almost has to be in your portfolio. It is in my portfolio, and I've held it for many years. I have a core position. Michael, what I do, and you've heard me talk about this on CNBC, and we've probably talked about it, is I do trade around on the edges of Apple. So that, for instance, earlier this year, back in February and March, and I was pretty prolific on CNBC about this, stock was down around 120. I added to it. Underperformed the market at that point in time. Since then, it has rocketed up. Now, I'm going to continue to ride it, but I will tell you, there is a probability right now around 154. If this thing gets up towards 170, it's highly likely that those additional trading shares that I bought in February come out. You know, yeah. If the stock went from 120 to 170, I think I'd be foolhardy not to ring the cash register on that 40% gain in the trading shares, but absolutely maintain the core position because it's a fabulous company and because of the tax situation. So I have to have an alternative stock that can do 25 percentage points better than what I think Apple is going to do in order to make that switch. That's not likely to happen. I'm more likely to hold on to the core position. And again, as I said, just trade around the edges a little bit.
And this is what keeps us worried. When Jim and I wring our hands, this is the sort of stuff we wring our hands over. It's not where the market is today or that it fell 3%. That's not it. It's how you manage a portfolio and risk. Jim talked about risk and the reward, how you manage risk through times like this. And the risk is ever changing and the risk is ever evolving. And so you really have to have a lot of situational awareness to see where the risk is creeping in, because part of your discipline is guarding against that risk. Jim Labenthal is a partner at Cerity Partners, a contributor on CNBC, and one of our great friends and my personal great friends on the Farcast. Thanks so much, Jim, for being with us. This is awesome.
Michael, I take so much from our discussions. I really thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, pal. We're going to be back, Dan Mahaffey, and we're going to be talking about this Supreme Court decision, what it means, and what are the consequences when we come back on the Farcast.
Michael Farr and the Farcast are proud to support Heroes, Inc. Heroes supports the spouses and children of law enforcement officers and firefighters who gave their lives in the line of duty to the greater Washington, D.C. community. Their singular goal is to honor the supreme sacrifice made by these individuals by caring for their families. Heroes' work begins within 24 hours of the tragic loss and continues indefinitely. We invite you to learn more about Heroes' mission at heroes.org. We hope that you will consider supporting Heroes as they endeavor to honor those who protect us. That's heroes.org. Heroes, here for you, here for good. And now, back to the Farcast and your host, Michael Farr. Welcome back to the Farcast. And now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back. Joining us now, Dan Mahaffey from the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, our senior political analyst on the Farcast. Hey, welcome back, Dan.
Good morning, Michael. Thanks for having me back.
We are glad you're back with us again this week. And very hard to have a Farcast without Mahaffey. You know, a day without Mahaffey is very much like a day without Mahaffey. With that on the record, and Harry put me on the record for that. Dan, I want to give you credit because you have been right. And folks who have been listening to the Farcast, I hope you have benefited from Dan's great advice. Going back to April through May, June, July, and August, Dan Mahaffey has been saying, looks like they might get close on passing a $1 trillion infrastructure bill. The other big bill is going to be bogged down. By the way, we're going to have a debt ceiling problem coming up in the fall, and there's no way they actually get through any kind of a debate or close to passing anything until September. Congratulations, Dan. Prescient, and the crystal ball is working. Nancy Pelosi has set a date of the 27th of September, which looks absolutely silly, as we hear on September 2nd, with none of this passed. And I'm seeing reports that suggest it could be December before they actually come to any conclusion, any kind of a vote, and all sorts of tax issues. And the progressives hate anything that looks like compromise. And the anybody who's even a moderate hates anything that looks anything like a progressive. So Washington is going to continue to be Washington. And we're trying to understand all of this and its impacts on the economy and markets. Dan, there has been a Supreme Court non-ruling, really, overnight that we're seeing this morning. Texas has passed a really interesting, restrictive new abortion law that says it limits the term during which a woman has access to an abortion. And at any point after that, there are fines and things going on. Explain what's going on. What's this law, first of all, that right. Texas passed, yeah. and why is it in the Supreme Court?
Well, first, and let's focus on the law here, because as we all know, abortion is such an emotional subject and one that I think the law and courts are probably the worst equipped to handle, given the emotional complexities of this and the hot button that it is. But to understand Texas's law, where it has basically pushed the envelope way beyond the previous precedent set by Roe and Planned Parenthood v. Casey, where you have basically said that no abortion can take place after a fetal heartbeat is present. A lot of doctors will say most women don't know that they have a child until well after that has taken place. The 6-week threshold is what they've put into place. And rather than
in Texas, they've put together a 6-week threshold.
Yeah, 6-week threshold. And to enforce this, rather than the state taking the lead, it is enforced by civil action that any citizen can then file to report someone who has had a procedure or aided and abetted a procedure. So does that mean the doctor? Does that mean the Uber driver who took someone to a procedure? Does that, all these questions?
Yes,
actually,
I've read a number of articles that suggest, yes, the neighbor who would drive the woman to the abortion would be subject to that $10,000 penalty. Yes?
Correct. And all of this would be not enforced by the state, but the person who reports this person then stands to make the $10,000 off the person they've reported.
They get the $10,000? You
yes.
make $10,000.
Because it's a civil action.
So you're paid for your vigilantism.
Correct.
Oh, so you get paid to turn in your neighbor.
Yes.
Have we seen this in any law? Is there any precedent in
Not
law
in the, United
in the U.S.?
States.
Huh?
Not in the United States.
Not in the United States.
I could draw a very labored comparison to certain things like whistleblower statutes. Obviously, we know a whistleblower gets
right.
a cut of
right.
what they report. There are other incentives, but we've never seen it in this way to specifically say, go report someone regarding this personal act.
Okay, so there are a couple of things. State passing a more restrictive abortion law is not particularly earth-shattering, correct? I mean,
correct.
States have to do that all the time, or try to,
yes,
and some hold up and some don't.
A lot of
huh?
more conservative states and conservative legislatures have tried to put various things forward.
Restrictions on the access right. to abortion, we've seen that, yes.
And generally they're struck down by the courts, where we have hearings. This was far more unusual in how this was addressed through
the quirky part of this, when the thing we haven't seen before is compensating an American citizen for turning in another American citizen.
Yeah, in that very direct way of saying that. Yeah. And how could this, because what the Supreme Court has done overnight was say that because of this mechanism, they weren't going to review or block this law until there was an actual case of someone being sued under this mechanism.
Okay, so this was appealed to the Supreme Court. It became law, I believe, on September 1st, yes?
Correct, overnight, 31st to the 1st. Last night, the Supreme Court, on their shadow docket, which is another unusual
measure.
Okay,
hang on. So this thing actually became law. It had been sent to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court then didn't actually consider it or hear a case, did they?
They did not hear a case. The justices were reviewed the matters before them and decided not to step in to block it before a hearing. And that's, again, a major shift. One, that they obviously did not block this relatively novel attempt by Texas legislatures to get around the issue of judicial review. That's why they chose this civil procedure model, and then doing it without a hearing. So it's merely written opinions delivered by the 5-4, the 5 more conservative justices and the 3 liberals and Roberts, the Chief Justice.
Chief Justice Roberts voted with
Breyer, Kagan, and Sotomayor.
With the liberals. Justice Roberts did that.
Robert saw this as a very large divergence from how the court should work or should address an issue as established as Roe v. Wade. And I think someone of Robert's stature, we know how focused he has been on the legitimacy of the court and its political insulation. It was telling that he would not join the other five on this.
Well, now let me. Robert's actually said that the Texas statute's enforcement plan is, quotes, not only unusual but unprecedented, is what he said about the plan. So, you know, I'm sitting there reading that thinking, excuse me, sir, you're the Chief Justice. I mean, if you don't like the way this is going.
But he's still only one vote of nine when it comes to how the shadow docket works.
Okay. Can you give us a 30-second primer on the shadow docket, what that means in the Supreme Court?
That's the process of the Supreme Court reviewing cases and deciding whether they will eventually take it when they go to hearings, whether to hold an emergency hearing. And basically, it is the justices, how they decide what cases to review, what laws to block pending review. And that exists as a docket below the court. That's you jockey for that to get your case heard there, decided there. But lately, a lot of decisions are effectively being made using that by A, choosing not to block or review new laws,
right,
and B, again, simply having, you know, these limited opinions. You know, these aren't long dissents or opinions, you notice on this, that simply, you know, address this without having a hearing.
So, Dan, let's back up. So we see that the court decided not to interfere with this very strange new law and procedure out of Texas. I mean, intuitively, the finding the loophole probably, in my opinion, won't last. It will be struck down in some court sooner or later here. It just is so strongly and strangely un-American.
Well, that, and it arguably won. We'll pull back a bit. One, you have first the change of this and how the court is looking at this. And yes, you described one, you know, there could very well be one of these lawsuits that then gets appealed and we have this case heard through a full thing. But that allowing it to take effect and allowing this to happen, one, I don't know who else is going to, you know, do you use this model for back child support in the future? Do you use this model for corporate
registering your car,
you know,
right,
sorting your recyclables. Where does this end?
Oh God, the sorting the recyclables. I have a neighbor who would absolutely multi-billionaire if they could benefit from reporting people for that and many other things. Oh, this one is just okay. So
politically,
Dan,
though.
Let's talk more broadly politically, because I watched and read that Kevin McCarthy is threatening some of the big tech companies to not release records and phone records from January 6th under privacy laws. And some of the big tech companies are saying we're going to cooperate. Google is going to cooperate with whatever congressional subpoenas they get. Other companies are not saying anything, but McCarthy has threatened them and said that there will be, you know, he's going to come after them if they do that. So very interesting that the Republican leader in Congress is saying, my privacy is too important and I can't have anybody looking in or eavesdropping. Yeah, and then we've got a court in Texas saying, we're going to pay you to look over your neighbor's shoulder here and pay attention to what they're doing.
McCarthy always impresses me because it's great when you can get obstruction of justice, contempt of Congress, and statism all in one, in one statement.
Oh, the trifecta.
That's perfect. A trifecta. But beyond that, I want to zoom out even further. The politically, what we saw over the past couple of weeks with Afghanistan, the bungled issues with Delta across the country, the kind of turbulence with their economic plans in the White House, we saw Biden's numbers slip. Biden had been pretty Teflon for the first 8 months of his presidency. And when it was finally on what Biden was doing and the decision making and how the White House is working and the focus was their agenda, he started to slip. It was very telling when the focus was on him. When the focus moves to culture war laws and Texas and the anger of women voters, when the attention focuses on January 6th, when it focuses on conspiracies about 2020 and people, forsaking the vaccine for horse dewormer, then Biden's numbers go back up. So the question is, how long can you, when the focus is on what's actually happening in reality, Biden slips. But when you fall back into these culture war tropes and trench lines, it does not help the Republicans at all in their efforts to derail this.
You're saying the Republicans just broke Churchill's biggest rule, right?
Right.
Churchill's rule is never interrupt your enemy when he's making a mistake.
Right.
Biden was doing just fine in losing Biden's numbers. And now the Republicans have gone to that third rail of American politics. And no, it's not Social Security, folks. Do you know that in the past presidential elections, in the past four or five and maybe more, the number one or number two issue for American voters has been abortion? Of all the things out there, when you fill out a questionnaire, if you go to an online service to say, there are these wonderful things online where you can, they will give you a quiz and how do you feel about this issue, and this issue. And then they will say you match up best with this candidate. And then they will tell you the issues that are important, most high priority importance to most Americans. It's still abortion is number one or number two, which is kind of stunning to me in that this decision was made almost 50 years ago in Roe versus Wade in the Supreme Court. This has been law for 50 years, and it's still the number one issue. So we've gone there. Interesting to see how this will turn out, but there's a great deal at stake. It certainly sounds like, Dan. How does this get settled out? What are the next steps for this Texas law? And then I want to move on quickly here.
Yeah, well, we'll see how suits actually take place under it. It definitely lights a fire on those particularly progressives who say we need to reshape the court, either expand it or adjust its procedures, what cases it can take. Look, there's going to be also a lot of movement, I think, at the state level where states can try and put Roe v. Wade into law where they haven't already, but it's definitely changing I think it's changed the focus of the past few weeks politically. Just when, Biden was having a terrible August, we turned the calendar to this.
Very interesting article in the Washington Post, and we're going to finish up here, Dan. Justice Stephen Breyer, 82 years old, one of those who was appointed by a Democratic Party president, is seen as one of the liberal justices, is being pressured to retire under Biden's, really, before that 2022 election, just to make sure that President Biden has the votes for his next Supreme Court justice. Breyer made a very interesting argument in his interview with the Washington Post and in his recent book, which was it's a mistake to see justices as flavored or colored by the party of the president who appointed them, that when a justice takes a seat as a justice, they are beholden to the law. And they're there to support the law, and they do it in a nonpartisan way with a deep devotion to the law and the Constitution, and it goes beyond party. That sounds wonderful, and I thought it was just magnanimous to hear from Justice Breyer, but somehow the votes don't look like they work out that way, do
right.
they?
I respect Justice Breyer, his wisdom and his service to the country, but the past 48 hours have shown that is he's looking at the past through rose-colored glasses.
Well, with the exception of Justice Roberts, I think we have to give Justice Roberts, he's been very independent on
right.
any number of issues and has voted with the, quote, liberal justices any number of times. I think he follows his own mind and seems to follow the law, absolutely. And by the way, I know Chief Justice Roberts, I should disclose, I just think he's one of the finest people I've ever known. I just admire him greatly, personally, professionally. I mean, I think the guy's a rock star. But anyway, Dan, there's my plug. You're welcome, Mr. Chief Justice. I'm sure you were hanging. You were waiting for the forecast.
Well, when that case gets before him, where the where you're sued for losing your client's money under some vigilante law, he'll be.
He's such a Boy Scout. He'll recuse himself right when I need him, to kind of give me the wink and the nod. No, he'll take a powder. Dan, anything?
I will be reported $10,000 for bad podcasting.
Oh, Jesus, we'll go broke. Anything? Tell me the chance of getting an infrastructure bill passed before December 31st, Dan.
Which infrastructure bill? There will be an infrastructure bill passed. 100% there's a bill that gets passed by December 31st. How this gets made, that's going to be how this gets made into a meatball that everyone can somehow eat is the, to borrow from Kenny, perhaps. But that'll be how we discuss this next time when we're looking at how all these packages are coming together. The two infrastructure plans, the defense bill, the debt limit, the budget for next year, all of this coming at looking like everyone trying to enter the Lincoln Tunnel at rush hour as we come into fall.
That's what it feels like right now. It feels like everybody's trying to get in the Lincoln Tunnel at once, particularly on the legislative agenda, and everybody has an issue. And it feels like, Washington is normal, as dysfunctional, and on steroids. I mean, everybody who's got an issue is now seeing it magnified. Dan, let's not forget China. I want to talk about China next week. You and I are working on an op-ed that will come out next week. It's going to be published next week. We'll make our final tweaks. But we have a very new take on China, Dan, you and I, and I think it's fascinating. It's going to be very important to markets. Next week, ladies and gentlemen, on the Farcast, I'm going to drill down, Dan and I, on China, what it means, what they're doing, and will China give in? Will China give in to the almighty yuan? In the end, they might. Ladies and gentlemen, Dan Mahaffey from the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. Coming up, we're going to talk with Josh Huminski. And Josh is an expert, international expert on security issues, went to the War College in London. And we're going to talk about what went on in Afghanistan, what it means and the ramifications around the world. And when we look at the U.S.'s political position and U.S. might, both economic influence and military influence, that has an effect on markets, on our confidence, on our business, on our future. We're going to talk with Josh Huminski when we come back on the Farcast. Please stay with us.
Thank you for joining us on the Farcast. And now back to your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back. Joining me now, Josh Huminski is the director of the Mike Rogers Center for Intelligence and Global Affairs, founded by former congressman and chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, Mike Rogers, at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. We're having sort of a CSPC show here today, Harry. But, when you find brilliant people, you go with brilliant people wherever they are. We're very fortunate to find them. Josh received his master's degree in war studies from King's College London after completing a dissertation on energy security and international relations, undergraduate honors degree from the University of Connecticut in political science, thesis on U.S. military relations. Very qualified to be speaking to us today about Afghanistan, our withdrawal, what that means politically, what it tells the rest of the world about us. Welcome to the Farcast, Josh.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a very exciting time to be talking about this. And unfortunately, at the same time, a bit of a tragic time to be talking about this, given everything that's happened in the certainly the last 48 hours.
No question about that. And so this war without end that, you read, if you read a book, a very popular book a number of years ago called Charlie Wilson's War.
Great movie, too.
I mean, it was a great book, but I mean, it talked about how everybody who's tried to go into Afghanistan has failed and why, and it actually explained very clearly why it was impossible to be successful in tribal Afghanistan. Tell us exactly, okay, so give us a quick précis of what happened in Afghanistan and why we decided to leave. What were we trying to do in Afghanistan and why did we decide to leave?
Well, I think you nailed the crux of the problem right on the head there. So immediately after 9/11, the United States probably had the best chance of a realistic strategy in that country, which was to go in, unseat the Taliban, and defeat Al-Qaeda. We did that in a matter of weeks. It surprised the United States to an incredible degree. But then after that, we spent the last 20 years fighting a one-year war at a time. Every single time it came up, it was an expansion of the mission. It became installing a democracy, a presidential democracy, in a country that didn't have a history of that. It became, let's defeat the drugs trafficking and the opium trade in Afghanistan, which would have been cheaper to just outright buy all of the opium that came out of Afghanistan per year, rather than spending $2.2 trillion.
We should have done it. And what a great idea. It would have been cheaper, and think of the lives that would have been saved. Oh, my God.
Absolutely. And that's the tragedy of all this. What happened is the political class in Washington never defined a viable, achievable military achievable political end. Strategy 101 is you have to have a political solution to the challenge. And the political class in Washington never adequately did that. So did we have operational success in Afghanistan? Absolutely. Did we have mission success in Afghanistan? Absolutely. Was that connected to anything that was strategically achievable? Unfortunately, no. And that's where we found ourselves at the end of August, where we had a precipitous and frankly reckless withdrawal. When we knew this was coming, it should have been done better and more efficiently and more effectively, everything from getting rid of the equipment that was left over there to getting the SIVs out of the country to everything in between. Unfortunately, that was the period to the sentence that we have been looking at since 9/11 that has just been written and rewritten and rewritten at, unfortunately, a great deal of blood and treasure cost.
Yeah, no question about that. So I understand, and I think popular opinion certainly says that the withdrawal from Afghanistan was a complete, what do you call that certain type of show? I can't quite remember what you could, there's a name for it, a certain type of show. That suggests something that was less than perfect. So that was ugly getting out of there.
Charlie Foxtrot is another phrase for it.
Yes, indeed. So if we look at this truly botched exit, was it, let's forget the botching. Was it right that we exit was now as good a time as any? Because that's kind of what I'm hearing President Biden say.
I think the problem is President Biden is framing it in a very binary construct. It's either we're all in or we're all out. And in so doing, has framed it in such a way that I'm not going to perpetuate the forever war. I'm not going to bequeath this war to another administration. And that's a false framing of the construct.
Why is it false?
Well, the United States maintained a presence in Afghanistan after 2014 when President Obama effectively declared the war over. We didn't have combat troops there, but we did. We had individuals who were doing advised training and assist missions. They were special operations forces on the ground.
Why were we continuing to do that?
To buttress the Afghan National Defense and Security Forces, to push back against the insurgents, to push back against the Islamic State Khorasan.
Why did we have to buttress them?
Because unfortunately, they could not stand on their own. And that's really where it led to what happened to the precipitous collapse of the security forces and the government.
But standing on their own was to protect and preserve this new presidential structure that we helped establish?
So we had helped. We established a presidential democracy. We were buttressing up the Afghan defense forces to give the Afghan government breathing space, to give them security, and to push back against the Taliban, which was very much a losing prospect in the long run. But what was achieving was with those special forces and with those security forces, they were making successes. They were holding back the flood tide of the Taliban. We had built a military that was modeled after the American military, which was very indirect fire and direct fire supported. So artillery, air support, close air support, the A-10 Thunderbolt, things like that. And that model works when you have that support and those people on the ground who can control that. When you remove that, which is what we did effectively by pulling back, by ending the contractor support for the Afghan Air Force, when you pull back all of our forces entirely, you saw what happened, which was the Afghan National Defense Security Forces collapse. It said, the United States is pulling out. They're not going to back us. They're not going to support us. And so we need to figure out what's going to be best for their own individual survival. And that's how you saw that sort of house of cards collapse.
So I'm going to suggest that for whatever reasons, it sounds like figuring out that this needed to come to an end because there were no longer any identifiable goals was probably as good a decision as any. Would you agree with that?
I don't disagree with the president's construct of what our strategic national interests were in his speech when he spoke, I think, about 2 weeks ago.
Would you have done it, though? I mean, you're president of the United States. Would you have gotten us out of Afghanistan? Would you have said this needs to come to an end?
I would have said that the mission needs to be restructured, but the way that it was done was wrong.
What would you have done?
I actually would have agreed with what the president said when he was vice president, which was when he was in office under President Obama, he advocated a policy of counterterrorism plus. It was not counterinsurgency. It was support the Afghan government as much as possible to buttress the National Defense and Security Forces, but maintain a very aggressive counterterrorism posture through military special operations, CIA paramilitary forces, and drone strikes to keep Al-Qaeda, to keep ISIS, to keep these other groups off balance, but to not be responsible for or had the expectation of creating and sustaining a Jeffersonian democracy with a market-based capitalist system, which is what we were trying to do in Afghanistan fundamentally for the last 20 years.
You know, so, I want to move on to the international implications. I think I am so glad to talk to you today, and you are brilliant. This is really fun. What I'm learning so much. You know, I was I was friends with General Brent Scowcroft, and General Brent Scowcroft disagreed strongly, was best friends with President Bush 41, and he used to say he liked young George. He just didn't think he made very good decisions as president. And he said, young George has this misguided opinion that the world is yearning for democracy. He said, Michael, I've been all over the world. He said, there are a lot of cultures and a lot of governments and a lot of people who won't understand democracy and are not ready for democracy, and it's not right for them. What I have found around the world is that everyone is yearning for dignity. The one consistent common factor. But this idea that we're going to save the world by imposing democracy is absolutely just misguided. And what they need in Afghanistan and anywhere else is something that is truly and organically Afghani, that fits their culture and their priorities. And we need to figure that out. So and then do that while we're achieving our goals. I always loved his opinion and his insights there. And what you're saying makes me think that General Scowcroft was, again, pretty much right. So
I think it's looking and trying to develop. I look at things from a very strategic national security interest perspective. And that's where I think we can have the morals and values to motivate that perspective. But we need to be realistic about what we can achieve in any of these countries and globally. And that's where that cost benefit perspective.
Tell me now about the U.S.'s position around the world. Militarily, how are we seen? I mean, here I'm sort of saying, geez, I feel like I'm on my back foot a little bit as an American around the world. I don't feel like we have the same respect. I don't feel like people are all that jealous of being an American anymore. What's going on with our image around the world and our political effectiveness, our reach, I know what our economic reach is, but how is it seen?
I think we need to separate the two parts of the question. So there is the sort of crisis response and withdrawal from Kabul, which does look a complete and utter disarray. It does not make us look good. It undoubtedly raises questions in Moscow and Beijing and Taipei and Kiev as to our ability to respond to a crisis. We knew this was coming, so this was not a surprise, but we certainly looked like it was, we're suddenly withdrawing. We don't know what to do. So separating that from our credibility, I think, is important. There are a lot of commentators out there right now who are putting it out like this is, it's going to entice China to take Taiwan, or it's going to entice Russia to take Estonia or Latvia or Lithuania. And I don't agree with that, because I think it's a long reach to question the ability of the United States Navy or the United States Air Force to operate in the Asia Pacific region to deter or respond to a crisis in the Asia Pacific, or the NATO allies and partners to respond to Russian aggression. So our credibility, certainly it does make sense to wonder about that. Does it mean that we are fundamentally in a position where we are weakened and vulnerable? I don't agree with that as much, but it would be fair for all those capitals to be wondering. You know, COVID response wasn't great. Kabul withdrawal wasn't great. So can the United States respond to these crises, and where does it stand today? I don't think for a second you're going to see people questioning the ability of the United States Navy to project power or the United States Air Force to project power. in some ways, having the United States out of Afghanistan potentially frees up those resources to respond to other crises elsewhere. Uh-huh. Certainly, uh-huh. Russia and China love to see us bogged down spending trillions of dollars in Afghanistan because it meant that our attention was there, however much there was the Asia pivot under Obama or the Asia pivot under Biden. So now that we're out of there, we've made a strategic decision to withdraw. Granted, it was remarkably messy, but now the question is what comes next? And I think if you're Russia, if you're China, if you're Iran, the calculus gets a little more complicated now that you see that.
You have a certain expertise in military and war operations. What is the readiness and capacity of the U.S. and the U.S. military right now relative to our history and the rest of the world?
I think our readiness remains high. Just because of the withdrawal was messy, I don't think that negates or changes the fact of our ability to operate globally. I mean, we're still in 160 out of 180 countries and territories in various forms and capacity. We still have multiple carrier battle groups operating around the world. We still have all of our forward deployed forces around the world, and we can respond to crises in theory. That crisis response in Kabul definitely calls into question what we can do elsewhere. But I don't think our readiness has fundamentally changed. Again, that big question of the Asia Pacific, you've seen a lot of people saying, well, this just means that China is going to take Taiwan because the United States is going to respond. It's going to bend its allies. That is a very big leap of logic that I don't agree with.
Will the United States respond to aggression, Chinese aggression in Taiwan?
I believe so.
You do. How would we respond? This is fascinating. This is very, very dangerous for the United States and for China.
It's absolutely. I think this is the one trigger point where that strategic miscalculation could be very, very risky. If Beijing thought that they could take Taiwan and decided to take Taiwan, that would be a grave strategic miscalculation, because I do believe that the United States Navy, if we had strategic warning that this was going to happen, would push and forward deploy assets there, be it carrier battle groups, be it repositioning B-2s, B-52s, other platforms to places like Diego Garcia, to Japan, to Okinawa. To say, hey, we can deter you, we can respond, just because we have withdrawn from Afghanistan, which was a predominantly army-heavy, to a lesser degree, tactical and strategic air asset-heavy position and force, we can still respond. We still can deter. So I think that we could respond. We could deter that force if China decided that they wanted to do that. And that is where that grave miscalculation could happen, but I don't think it will.
That's very interesting. You've got to come back. I've got so many more questions for you. I've got so many, and I need Mahaffey to help with some of these topics that are running through my head right now. So I hope you'll please come back. I have one final question. You know, I grew up during the Cold War. We had drills where we would have to get under our desks in case there was a nuclear attack. It would have done us a lot of good if we'd been under that desk during that nuclear attack. But, you know, growing up, and I'm 60 years old, I have always, you know, in the back of my mind felt really good when I went to sleep at night that at the end of the day, the U.S. could actually step in, kick ass and take names. We were still the strongest guy on the street, and we were going to be quiet, and we were going to stop bullying, and we were going to be that good, strong guy out there if we needed to be. Do we still have that capacity, Josh, to be? To go in and kick ass and take names if we have to?
Yes.
We do.
I think 100% we do. And I think an American, if nothing else, the American people should have the utmost faith and confidence in the servicemen and women of our United States military. You know, purely budget-wise, we spend more than the next 7 countries combined, and we get a hell of a lot of bang for that buck. But most importantly is, you know, look at the, unfortunately, the 13 individuals, service members, the Marines, Navy corpsmen, and Army service member who were killed. You know, regardless of politics, regardless of political persuasion, they stood up, went out there on the front lines to defend the innocent, to defend American freedom, and to uphold those values. And they gave their lives willingly. If there is not a better example of the values of the American people and America, it's them right there. And so I think anybody who has any question about, you know, whether we will respond or stand up for our rights, the rights of the innocent, look to those 13 service members, you know, remember them, honor them, and that should give the best faith and confidence is more than anything that I can say.
Josh Uminski, is the director of the Mike Rogers Center for Intelligence and Global Affairs. And ladies and gentlemen, as you can hear, one of the brightest folks we've ever talked to on the Farcast, one of the most thoughtful and a great American. We will take your advice, Josh. We will honor. And Harry, will you make sure we are able to take a moment here at the end of the Farcast to honor those 13 lives and all of the lives of both those living and dead service people and Americans who have given their lives in the pursuit of this great American dream. Ladies and gentlemen, that's it for another Farcast. We will be back next week. We hope that God blesses you and your families, and that God blesses America. Talk to you next week. Bye.
We appreciate you listening in to this week's edition of the Farcast, and thanks to Michael's guests, Jim Labenthal, Dan Mahaffey, and Josh Heminski. As Michael said, we are grateful for the sacrifice of the 13 young Americans whose lives were lost in the service of their country, their fellow servicemen, and fellow humans in Kabul this past week. We are humbled by their sacrifice and by the sacrifice and devotion to all who have given their lives in the service of the country. We would also like to take a moment to thank some of our friends and our family who have served in this nation's armed forces, men and women who have been willing to place themselves in harm's way. Among these, Lieutenant Jim Labenthal, United States Navy. Seaman First Class Harry Farr, U.S. Navy. Colonel Stacy Reed, United States Army. Captain Harry Jennings, Jr., U.S. Army. Lieutenant Colonel Harry Jennings, Sr., U.S. Army. Petty Officer Nicholas Caskey, U.S. Navy. Specialist Sean May, U.S. Army. The words can sound trite, but we do earnestly and honestly thank you for your service. The Farcast comes to you weekly and is produced by Michael Farr and Harry Jennings and is available for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and all major podcast platforms. We would like to remind you that the Farcast podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered legal or financial advice. The information, statements, comments, views, and opinions expressed or provided in this podcast, including by speakers who are not officers, employees, or agents of Farr, Miller & Washington, are not necessarily those of Farr, Miller & Washington or any firm any of our guests may represent. Any mention of a specific security should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell, and please be aware that past performance is not a guide to the future performance of any security, index, fund, manager, or strategy. We strongly recommend you review with a financial professional before you make any investment decision. And if we can be of assistance at Farr Miller in Washington, please reach out to me at hjennings@farrmiller.com. We are here to help, and I'll be happy to put any of our listeners in touch with one of our investment professionals for a complimentary review of your portfolio and your investment goals. Take care, stay safe, and stay healthy. We'll be back with you next week with one more special summer edition before we begin Season 5 of the Farcast later this month. Go beyond the headlines with the Farcast. Wall Street, Washington, and the world.